This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Coulter, yet again, as you get every week. With me this week, the woman who has been stopped at the border of Canberra a number of times trying to get to her beloved Ash Arnott over the last week and a half or so, Jenny Screen. Welcome, Jenny.
I'm laughing, but it's probably true. Yeah, I would like to cross the border and see Ash, but have no fear, I've called him at least five times a day, so I'm still getting my Ash fix, but nice to be here, Rob.
Getting closer and closer to a restraining order being served on you at some point. We'll see how that plays out. And, of course, the man that has got the Dennis Lilly-style long run-up into Movember going on at the moment, Nathan Cooper-Brown. Welcome, Coops.
Thanks, Robbie. Good to be back.
Is this just a laziness thing or is this just a fashion statement?
Actually, my wife likes it, so I've got no excuse. So I'm gonna ride it out, see if I can get a few different Mo styles through the back end of this lockdown.
I like it. See if we can get something like mutton chops going on. Like, this could be a whole wheel of Coops going on.
That's it.
I like it. Thanks, everyone, yet again for jumping into the mailbag this week. We've got a number of questions that we'll go through. We always appreciate the likes, shares, the retweets, and the shares from anyone out there in Talking Split land. Of course, if you need to get us, you can get us with the hashtag Talking Split, usually on Twitter, but occasionally on the other social medias as well. Very rarely do I check them, but by the same token, Twitter might be your best chance. So, podcast today, we are going through the mailbag. We had part one last week with the Ash farewell. There is no Ash ceremony this week, mainly because no one liked it last week, Ash included. But we'll kick off with the mailbag. We are talking rubrics. This is your world, Jenny. So we've had a question from a listener that has spoken about what would you include in a rubric to help you select teams as we're coming into trial time for a lot of our clubs, hopefully.
Ooh, great question. Throwing me in the deep end. I guess it depends what you're looking for or what you're defining your team as and what the, you know, the, I guess the specific structure or identity you want your team to have. It might be a physical component. It might be an IQ component. I would hope when it comes to basketball, we do have a level of that left in our game. It's just not all about athleticism. There might be a level of coachability as well. I would hope that is also high on the radar when it comes to selections, especially when it's in a team environment, you know, the ability to be coached and adaptable in certain environments. So they'd be probably the top three that I would consider necessary. And then, you know, rubrics are one thing, but you've got to be careful that you don't get caught too much into the data and to the stats and the rubric per se. You also still have to have that a coaching eye, or what I say, the art of coaching, and have that ability to just see, sit, observe, and just get a gut feel for someone, or in the way they move, or what they, how they express themselves, both physically and I think also in terms of their body language as well, to make you have a certain decision about them. And also with that, I think we also need to make sure with rubrics or ever how we're defining a player or a team, that people change. So whilst you might have an X against someone for this time round in a selection process, given that we work with developmental players in the pathway, everyone is maturing at different rates. So you always have to keep an open mind. So I think sometimes coaches get so bogged down in, oh no, Johnny, he wasn't that great, you know, 6 months ago, he's just going to be as bad, and he just gets knocked off the team before he's even stepped on the court for the trial. So, you know, I plead for coaches to keep an open mind when they're in their selection processes as well.
Would you,
I hope I answered that in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, you have. Would you go against the data? Like, is that something that the gut feel would override the data in that situation?
Yeah. Even though I come from a sports science background, and Coops is a big data man, I know he loves his data. And don't get me wrong, being a scientist, I like data, and I know black and white's really important to me, but some things just can't be answered, and you need to have that ability to go along the spectrum and along the line of, yes, when is the data helpful? What is the actual data telling me? How can I break down the data? But then also, how can I just use my coaching skills or my coaching hat? So, yeah, sometimes I do go against the data, and 9 times out of 10, it's more my gut that tells me things rather than the data.
What about you, Coos? What would you be looking at if you were to have some data involved in your trials and the like?
I'd be remiss if I didn't say shooting, Rob. right? I mean,
without doubt,
can't go
threes and layups.
Sorry, sidestepping the data question. I think shooting's just a big one, just in terms of the way that the game's going, and then you can, adjust the shooting to, again, kind of what Jenny's talking about with the end in mind, and it's taking a poke at threes and layups. But if you're with a younger team, I think your shooting rubric or your shooting segment would be more heavily based on technique. And how does that look, and how much time is going to be invested in developing that aspect of the game, and how much of their shooting is going to help performance and so on. So I think that one you got to have. I think a game too, which probably comes back to a little bit of data, is thinking about the makeup of your team. And again, I know I'm kind of stepping on Jenny's point, but is your rubric going to give you 10 of the same player? And if you're thinking about philosophy and style of play and potentially how you want to perform as a group, are you happy to do that? Are you going to be positionless and switch everything and so on? Or do you want a little bit more of a traditional makeup? Are you looking for a post player and a point guard and some wings? And then you need to think about how does your rubric adjust to those sort of things? Because obviously what you're looking for in a point guard isn't necessarily what you're looking for in a post. So again, just coming back to that ultimate point of, this is the best place to start with the end in mind. What are you looking for, and how you can design a rubric to get you there?
Makes sense. So given the way basketball is generally played, would you take a better athlete over a better skilled athlete?
If they're both evenly skilled, but one can get there quicker in terms of based on athleticism, we're just looking at a sprint speed. I'm looking at probably taking the athlete, but there's room to look at, okay, well, is the more skilled person just hasn't had time invested in their athleticism. So, can we take their high skill base and work on their S&C to make them a better athlete? So I don't think it's just as cut and dry anymore. I think there's more nuance to it.
I like it. Jenny, you any different?
Great question. I think depends how long you have with them. So I think if you don't have a lot of time with them, I would be probably taking the more skilled person along if the tournament is really close by. That's just me, because obviously the more athletic person is great, but if they can't catch or facilitate things that you need in the structure of your style of play, then that's going to be a hindrance. So I think context is everything. But if you've got more time, then I would invest that, and they're younger and they're in the pathway, then you know that the more athletic kid or the longer kid is going to need more time. Ash used to,
No good.
Oh, no. The green bananas, he used to call them, they're not ripe yet. So I think that's a good analogy for the kids that are of length and long and athletic, that they do need more time. But a short amount of time, I'm taking the more skilled kid.
Yep, makes sense. Coops, we're living in your world here. You've been a director of coaching before of a program. So should you be providing the session plans to your coaches from within your program, or should they be providing you with their session plans from their training sessions?
Just to go on that fantastic answer that all coaches and people love that Jenny just used, it depends. I think, there's room for the DOC to be involved and set up some really specific session plans. And obviously there's reasons behind that. One, maybe they want to show the template that they think is a good one that can be used. Maybe there's some program style of play things that they want addressed. Again, there should be real reason for it. But then obviously on the other hand, one of the big parts of coaching is being able to create a session plan, something that addresses, the teaching areas, that has great flow to it, that has adaptability into it. And you can't do that unless you have, trial and error and experience and all the things that come with it. So, there's times for it, but at the end of the day, coaches need to be able to create sessions, that maximise development in their athletes and their teams.
Yep. What about you, Jenny? Would you do anything different, given you lead a program at the moment? Do you dictate to what your coaches should be doing, or do you rely on their input too?
I'm probably a bit of the latter. I think it's fraught with danger having too much control. I think then you impart your take or your coaching onto other coaches who might see things differently, and then you're only, you know, creating yourself. So you're never challenged or whatever, because obviously younger coaches are going to be more influenced by you and those type of things. So I'm probably the latter. I think I would say, though, that early on in the piece, I think it's really good to give directives similar to what Coops was saying, give them understanding and teach them how to actually write a program, what it should look like, actually potentially give them feedback on their lesson plans, or perhaps the DOC writes ones, you know, for the first 6 weeks, so they get an understanding of the flow and how you interact certain things in the program that you're wanting. And then you go, okay, now it's your turn, and I want to see what you've learned, because otherwise, if you're always feeding them something, it's just like you become the parrot. You're just reciting what you've read in a book or without any application. So I think it's really important to allow coaches to find their expression and their identity as a coach whilst having those little skill sets from the DOC, but then they can start to add in their own, I guess, identity as well.
Yep. And there's a level of accountability that goes with that too. Like you do want a level of check-in with the DOC and the coach. Like there should be a little bit of a flow back and forth between, here's what our session plan looked like this week. Can you give me some feedback on it? Is there anything I've missed that you really want from a head of basketball or DOC type role? But it also makes sure that they're doing session plans. I've lost count the amount of times you turn up to a training session and say, where's your plan? Like, oh, it's in my head. Like, yeah. Is it in your head, or are you just kind of making this up as we go along with it? So I don't think it's a bad thing for session plans to go up to the DOC, but also I agree with your point there, Jenny, and similar to what you were making as well, Coops. It doesn't hurt, especially early on in the piece, to give a little bit more direction with here are the expectations of the program. In particular, teams get picked, those kinds of things as well. I think it's a really good way of having at least some open conversations about it too.
I think part of that too, Rob, to remember is, you know, is there not necessarily a directive, but is there a philosophy and a purpose in the club around, you know, where they want teams and athletes to go? Like, especially if you're talking about being a pathway club and maybe you have an NBL 1 program and you want homegrown athletes filling out that roster, you know, what do you want taught and how does the club align with bringing those players along? And I think that is definitely part of what you're talking about, that there's a message that can move up and down, and that could potentially make its way into session plans. But like you both mentioned, that, you know, at the end of the day, it's got to be the coach working through it.
I think a good example is, like, you know, for us at BV and our state development program, we use points of emphasis. So every block we have points of emphasis that we want to ensure our coaches are incorporating into their session plans. And then I'm also big and, you know, is the type of language they're using. So when they do come to camps, then they're not hearing words from potentially me or Coops or Zoe or, you know, our incoming new Ash that is foreign to them. Like, hang on, I don't know what you mean here. So I think, you know, having your points of emphasis, having the language of which your DOC or your club wants to use and the, I guess, the catchwords that they can pick up on are really, really important. But I think it's really also to harp on is to keep it simple. You can't build Rome in a day. So your points of emphasis should be very small in a block window sense. Yep.
Makes sense. We'll stick with you here, Jenny. What age should you start athletes getting into the world of S&C and what would it look like?
Oh, great. I love this one. Potentially because I studied it, but there is this taboo out there that children of young age shouldn't be lifting, which is actually not true at all. Like, there's, oh, you're stunned how growth, we're not going to become tall. That's actually not the case at all. If anything, I would encourage people as young as 13, 12 to start being unaware of their bodies and how to move properly and express themselves with force and then how to absorb force. Now, that doesn't mean you throw a kid in the gym, you put a 20-kilo bar on them and you load them up. Just like we don't start kids at the three-point line and teach them how to shoot a basketball. It's the same premise. Like, we start in close and we work our way out. It's the same in the gym. You work on technique, refining movement patterns first. Once they're competent, then you load. And I think kids need to, if this is anywhere we're behind the eight ball, I think if we compare ourselves to America, and we like to compare ourselves and want to be America a lot of the time, is that they do this very early on, especially in high school. It's a big part. And then obviously we know in college as well, it's fundamentally a part of their program. So I'm really, I would love to encourage coaches to, and this doesn't mean you need to be in a gym, don't get me wrong. How can you incorporate stuff into your training sessions? You know, I love, you know, coaches like to punish their kids by doing running. Don't do running. Do like a plank, and don't do push-ups, because I hate seeing kids do push-ups poorly. But do like a plank, or do a hold top of a push-up, and you've got to dribble the ball at the same time. You're not only working on your dexterity of your skill and your dribbling, but you're also working on how to actually activate your core and your trunk at the same time. So it's little windows of opportunity there that you can actually incorporate S&C. But for those out there that are fearful, especially parents, about I'm going to stunt my kids' growth and all that, I'm more than happy to provide you with 1,000 papers that that actually is not true, one iota in terms of that concept that you've heard.
Well, and it's funny because you've hit on a question that we had pegged for later in the podcast, which is, should you use conditioning as a consequence of behavior or mucking around at your training sessions? And you have hit us with a no, don't run them, but make them do something that is maybe a little bit uncomfortable that is potentially going to help them. So planks are not comfortable for the vast majority of us, myself very much included, but is a good way of at least saying, well, look, you've lost the drill, or you're mucking around a little bit, jump over there into a plank where they can't annoy you for a little while as well. Like, there's ways of sort of slipping it in without them realizing that it's in there.
Correct. I mean, I don't know where I stand on the running thing. Sometimes you probably just get fed up and you just like get on the baseline. I know as a player, I used to be like, oh, the baseline, like, here we go. But I don't know. I think sometimes it loses, if you use it all the time, it loses its, I guess, value. But yeah, it depends on the culture you're trying to establish and those type of things. But I have been watching SAS a lot in the last couple of weeks, and I'm just like, oh, I would love to just, you know, say some of those things that they're saying occasionally, but you know you can't because you'd never have a job again. But I definitely could see Ash doing that.
Absolutely.
100%.
Now's probably the time we start the petition to get Ash on season 3 of SAS. Like, he may not need to know about it. He'll just get a random phone call out of the blue saying, look, we'd like you to come on here and just be abused for a little while.
Oh, it would be brilliant though too, the sarcasm and the wit and the in the face. Oh, it's him all in a T. But yeah, I'm torn between the running thing, but I think we can get more crafty with how we try and instill. I don't even know what you're trying to instill by punishing people, but I think there's better ways to go about it.
Coops, from your experience, how have you seen coaches implement this effectively into their programs, where it's a little bit easier, I suppose, when they sort of get to that under 14, under 16 age group, because they understand it a bit more, they know there's a little bit more to this. What about like an under 12 team that's looking to do something sort of conditioning-wise with their athletes?
Well, I've got a story for you, Rob. when I was in college and I played 2 years before I transferred and came home, I know I've spoken a little bit about it before in the pod. My coaches, and they really burnt me out. They had a theory that they were going to run us until we could hardly stand, and then we were going to play basketball because they wanted to mimic the fourth quarter every time we were practicing. So training got pretty old pretty quick. And then what they also did was they finished every practice with a 17 in a minute. And for those that don't know, that is across the court and back is a 1, 2, 3, 17 times in a minute. And if we didn't get it, we had to do it again. So the amount of times that we would walk into practice, and I know me especially, with that 17 in a minute in the forefront of my mind. So I'm not even invested in practice. All I'm worried about is I've got to have enough energy at the end of this 2.5 hours to get this 17 in a minute. And you know, that's just not an effective way of trying to get people to enjoy their basketball and develop and so on. So I think one of the things to look at, especially younger, is talking about the value of competition and how important that is. I mean, I guess in both life on and off the court, but if you're talking about especially young people that want to be elite, that they want to play at the highest level, you have to have a competitive edge. You have to be a competitive beast. And there's ways to start talking about that and fostering that. And at the end of the day, if you lose a game, a drill, an activity, whatever it may be, there should be no running punishment that is as tough as the internal fire of your competition, that you're so upset and frustrated and ready to go again because that's the person you are, that's the athlete you are. So I think just more time spent in that space. What I'll do with my athletes, we'll do one or two push-ups, one star jump, one push-up, just a reminder, hey, yep, you lost. And then, you know, we're into what's next. But I'd be lying if my old school gene didn't put the players on the line every now and then. When
100% it would, Coops, 100%.
Yeah. So I can't, I've got to be careful there. But I think that's where you should start.
Yeah. I think it also comes back to how you build your culture. And what the expectations are, have you set that, those parameters and responsibilities and roles within the team or in your program early on so that they know where the line is. And once they cross that line, I'm not big on the punishment. I'm just like, there's the door. See ya. Take your bag. Because I think that hits home harder than getting on the line and I just get to run with my mates and potentially use this as getting fit. It's pretty humiliating to be told it, and you don't have to rant and rave about it. Just like, I'm done, take your bag and go, you know, you work it out. And I think it's really important though, that you have a discussion before you do that, depending on the level of where they've gone with their attitude or whatever, making sure, are you okay first? Because sometimes I think there's reasons why they're doing it, and maybe because they just hate you as a coach and they think you're an asshole. But it could also be, hey, something's gone on in their life. They've had a crap day. Are you okay? Is there anything wrong? No. Well, this behavior is unacceptable, blah, blah, blah. So I think there's better ways, but that was where I would start. Culture's really big.
Something else too, Rob, I've experimented with some of the younger kids is using the skill as the quote-unquote punishment. So we get straight into a small-sided game. You know, we're competing, we're playing, we're learning through that doing. And then if some of the skill stuff isn't kind of where it needs to be, maybe it's an outside hand push pass or ball handling, something we usually don't have as much time for in a team-orientated session, we would come out of the small-sided game and work on the skill. Hey, we've got to get this skill right before we can go back in and do the fun stuff. And then on top of that is if you've got a great session plan, coming back to what we spoke about earlier, and you're really getting up and down and you've got great flow and you're moving from one, you know, activity to the next and you're pushing the kids, well, you should be able to get your conditioning out of that. You should be able to get your conditioning out of the session without feeling like that the running punishment is necessary.
Yep. I think, I mean, you're hitting a couple of good points there. I think it's the skill isn't working in particular, or you lose a drill because of a skill, there's no point running them. Like the skill is the deficiency there, so have them work on the skill and try and get them better so they don't lose the next time around. But you've segued into one of the other questions. You guys are smashing this today. It's almost like, just for everyone's knowledge, I did give them the option of, do you want to know the questions before we start this? And they both said no. So this is 100% unintentional. But what's the balance between individual player development and team concepts at a standard practice for you, Coops?
This is a big one for me on just in terms of timing of this question coming off my last two NBL one seasons, had basically no budget. You know, had to take youth kids up into NBL one, which was really tough. And I got a little bit caught up in still trying to be the professional coach I wanted and establish an environment that replicated an NBL environment. But we got way too tactical and we got way too team orientated. And at the end of the day, we were evaluating games. And obviously, you know, our record was a tough one with our lack of depth and talent. But, you know, we were having really good possessions in areas that were letting us down from the individual standpoint, you know, the shooting or the closing out or whatever it may be. And that was a mistake by me in both seasons, not going back in practice and spending enough time in the individual skill development part or the small sided game part in being more specific. So if I had to put a number on it, you know, maybe 40-60, so 40%, you know, try and get a lot of shooting, try and get a lot of breakdown stuff in, and then obviously take that into more 5-on-5 games approach. But yeah, I just don't think you can gloss over it at any level. It's always, you know, if you do, come back to bite you. And that definitely happened to me twice. So hopefully I'll learn the next time around.
What about you, Jenny? You've got two different experiences, obviously, with like the Halebury team where you're coaching a team to try and win games, but obviously with the VMPP athletes where you're probably working on more refined skill set. How do you balance out the individual versus the team concept?
Yeah, for me, it's more what level of age am I working with? So if it's the younger ones and even at Halebury, it's the same. Like, I'm teaching the kids to pass and catch and dribble and be better with their skills, because if they don't have that, it doesn't matter what we run, we're not going to be able to execute it. So I'm all about fundamentals at a young age, probably a little bit different to most. And it's the same with NPP. It's more personal development, skill development would override, I think, most of the competition. And if you can instill in your kids to be able to run the floor, you know, transition basketball, get out and fly the lanes, then that in itself creates opportunities. Then if they can dribble at the same time and pass and catch and cut, you know, I think is one of the underrated skills that we don't seem to use much anymore, then that is far more beneficial in my eyes at a younger level than it is to be worrying about systems of play. We could sit and have these arguments for hours, but I that's just where I sit. Now, the further we go up into more elite or NBL1, like Coops was saying, I think that drop down a little bit more, but I still think it's important because it depends, one, how much time these athletes or players are getting their hands on the ball. If they're semi-pro like NBL1, well, they might not have chance. They might even be training twice a week or, you know, twice a week plus an indie. So they're not getting that refinement of skill as much as they'd like to, as or you would as a professional athlete. So I think it's a bit of give and take for me, but you know, as always, it depends.
We need a button for that. It's going to come up a fair bit, I would suggest. It's so how would you go about, and we all have this myth, I suppose, as coaches that one system is more superior than the other system. And if that was the case, well, everyone would just run the same system. And we've seen that a little bit over the years. And everyone's going down this motion pathway, which is fine. Like, no issues with that. Do what you do. How do you get motion to a point where it is still motion offense, where they're still making reads and decisions without it being so predictable that they no longer have to make any decisions and reads because it becomes a rule? In which case, it may as well be like any standard offense that you've got. How do you find the line with a motion offense to get it so that they're actually making decisions on the fly and reading the defense? Jenny, you look deep in thought. We'll throw it to you first.
No, it's just, yeah, like you beat me to it when you said, oh, you know, you put in these rules so it goes from being motion to actually being like offense. And it's so true. Like you look at flow, that you know exactly what's happening first side, second side. I dribble at you, your back cut, you know, is that motion or is that an offense? I like the idea of motion in its simplest form, from what I remember, purely to get movement and get people to be able to touch the ball and create cuts and all those type of things. So from that perspective, I love motion. I'm probably more, I love the structure and the chess piece of the game, like where is our advantage, where are we going to get easy scores from, do I have littles that I can post up and go to work, can I get big to little screens or little to big screens to create a switch and a mismatch and an opportunity, whereas I think now motion just allows a lot of switching to occur and we just go through the motion rather than recognizing the opportunities in front of us. So it's a really hard line, and I don't know if I can give you an answer to this one. I don't know, Coops, what have you got?
Yeah, for me, I mean, the motion title really is just, it's more about playing out of concepts and you know, what Jenny's talking about there is, you know, utilizing those concepts to create those advantages. And I think once you properly layer in your concepts, you can get to a point where it does open up and you've got a lot of things kind of moving and happening that becomes a lot more read and react. Whereas I think what some coaches are doing are living in maybe one or two concepts, which kind of brings it back to that more prescriptive type offensive play. And so if you really are keen on developing a full read and react motion, then, you know, you need to invest the time, you know, pass and cut, pass and screen away, ball screen, gets action. And it obviously, and the whole thing keeps layering, like, you know, you're just scaffolding on top. I think once you're at that point, you have it, but otherwise it's an understanding of utilizing concept for advantage and having great movement off the ball, which is what Jenny alluded to earlier in terms of cutting and spacing. I think if coaches are a little bit more focused on those two areas, you'll build better read and react players that then can absorb more teaching and more layering to get you to a real five-man read and react motion offense.
Because I think the vast majority of people would anticipate motion being just pass, cut, replace. Like, that's probably our first exposure to it, I would suggest, at that point. And then all of a sudden, you don't realize just how far down the rabbit hole you go there, because it's not just pass and cut. Sometimes it's stand and back cut, which sometimes it's shallow cuts with dribble entries. Sometimes it's on a reversal, then it's going to be a handoff or an on ball on that side. It's bloody hard. Like, by the time you get down that rabbit hole and you start trying to implement everything over the top, there are so many reads that players will have to make that you can't fit everything in, especially when we're talking 12s and 14s athletes type things.
Yeah. And motion takes time because you have to develop relationships with the people you're playing with. Like, you know, the shuffle offense, whether you want to call it motion or not, but that became so good because they played the system forever. Like, and then they had the players that suited the system. So you had great passers and you had great cutters, and motion takes time. And that's the thing that I don't think people realize. They think it's the easy option, but it actually, I think, is quite the opposite, because everyone has to be on the same page. And you see it all the time. A four or five is dribbling to the wing thinking they're going to do a handoff, but then and they start to pick up the ball, but then the player's back cut and they're like, you know, and they're not on the same page. They're not reading it. They're not in tune with one another. And yeah, that's where I think motion, sometimes it's great, and I'm all for the pass and cut and the simplicity of motion. But once you add, like you said, the rabbit hole and all the issues, that's when, you know, it can become bigger than Ben-Hur, and you're not on the one page. You've got 100 pages and everyone's reading a different one.
Well, and you don't really want play calls out of that either. Like, you're almost hoping that as a coach you become a bit redundant in that space, because the players are making the decisions, which at times can be fantastic, because then you get that lovely out after the game of, oh, we suck, but, you know, I turned the offense over to the players and this is what they dished up. They only scored 15 points, so it's not on me as a coach. But ultimately, it'll be probably what you put into your training sessions as well. Can you replicate a game situation at your training session where they now have to make a decision in that split second of, do I back cut? Do I come off a handoff? Do I come off an on-ball screen? And it kind of leads into the next part. So if you have your team, they've all been picked and all those kinds of things, how do you go about not pigeonholing players into, you're a tall, so you can only play in the tall positions or the post positions, you're a guard? Because we see it a lot. There are a lot of kids that will probably play in the post at club level, but as soon as they come into the BV pathway where there's posts all over the place, probably not as many as we'd like, to be fair, but there are more posts, all of a sudden they're going from that post to a wing and their skill set doesn't translate. But we know when they go back to club land, they end up in the post again, and that's not necessarily helping their long-term development. How do we combat this, Coops? What do we do in this space to help this issue?
Yeah, it's a big one. I think one of the places it starts is with the athlete themselves. So you have to have some self-awareness. I know I've spoken about it before, being, you know, one of my big trigger words, one of my values. You roughly know how big you're going to be. Obviously, the older you're going to get. So if you know you're going to be, you know, you're already 6'4", but dad's 6 foot, you know, maybe 7 foot isn't happening. So understanding kind of who you are, your role with the team you're at, and where you want to go, you should have some accountability around, okay, what am I going to do about this? And having some conversations with the coaches and the people around you. So your club coach, let's say you're an SDP or VMPP, and I've got a couple of athletes that are like this, played post their whole life, but they're only going to be 6'6", 6'7". So they're a wing at the next level. So this is a convoluted answer to come back and say, in the athlete's own time, they need to be working on the skill set for where they want to go. So, you know, sometimes it's tough. You're the tallest kid on your VJBL team, you get stuck in the post. It's going to happen. It's a fact of life in Victorian basketball. What are you doing outside of those sessions to prepare you for that move from post to wing when you get to a VMPP session or an Oz camp or wherever you're trying to go? So I think that's just an important part that hopefully some of our coaches will listen to that and can go and have those conversations with the athlete and say, hey, look, I need you down there on a Friday night, but here's some drills. Here's a program that you can be doing in your own time to help prepare you for that positional jump.
What about you, Jenny? What have you seen that sort of works in that space?
No, I think Coop's hit the nail on the head there with, you know, what are you doing in your own time to get you to where you need to go? And hopefully the coaches are providing that avenue and ability to explore that for their athletes and their players. And the unfortunate thing is VJBL, that you're there to win. So they're going to put players wherever they want to ultimately do that. And then you've got injuries and everything else. So you could end up having point guards in the posts who aren't really meant to be there, but that's all they've got to use. But anecdotally, for me, I was pretty much as tall as I am now when I was, you know, 14, 15. So I was in the post already. And let's just say I was a person of substance and, you know, leanness wasn't my thing back in the day. And I was quite robust, for want of a better word. And but I don't underestimate what you can learn in the post. People have almost got this, I don't want to be in the post because I'm not, and maybe it's a result of where we've gone. We don't use posts like we used to. But I, for me personally, learning how to use my body in the post, which I then took to be able to play defense, and then on the wing, learning how to lead for the ball, irreplaceable. Like, you know, learning how to fend someone off, learning how to use your feet in the post and fakes. So just whilst you might be back to basket, the principle is still the same. So if I move myself out and I'm front to basket, the footwork and the principles of my pass fakes and all those type of things and that of which I use are still exactly the same. So don't underestimate the value and importance of being in the post. We just got to learn how to, one, go back to using the post, and two, demanding the ball when we're in the post.
Yeah, and it's not easy because, let's face it, every Friday night team has 8 point guards, one semi-wing, and then one tall kid that you're taking a little bit of a chance on, and you sort of hope for the best when you get to that point as well. And I know that there have been some coaches in the past that have picked a kid that is potentially nowhere near up to a team, but by picking that athlete, and it allows them to play them in the post, which keeps their wings in the wing positions as well. And it's a bit of a sacrifice, and not always setting those athletes up for success because they are potentially going to be a little bit further behind where their teammates at, but it can actually really help keep your athletes in the right spot.
Yeah, that's an important part because it's not all on the athlete. You know, there's that duty of the coach to think long term. You know, it's not just about this VJBL season. And I know the coaches, it's tough because so much of it's designed to do that. But that, you know, there's a real responsibility there to help those athletes and think about what is their long term pathway, where are they headed, and what can they do to help that athlete, you know, put them in the best position to succeed.
It blows my mind that, you know, once you retire as a coach, I'm not sure you really talk about the championships you won at under 14s and under 16s at VJBL 1 level or whatever, and championship level. I would rather talk about, hey, I coached little Jenny when she was in under 16 and she went on to play for Australia. Like, I would hope that I had some part in that. Or I coached, you know, little Joe and now he's a boomer and all that. But I would want to hold my hat to that and not win VJBL and have a lot of kids go on to representative pathways and playing professionally than hanging my hat on winning 14s or 16s. But I've never been there, so, you know, it's easy for me to say that.
Yeah, and it turns out little Jenny was not necessarily little Jenny. She was robust Jenny, as we've since found out.
Very, very.
Excellent. Coops, you got more?
Oh, I was just going to say, can we have that as like a public service announcement where this just like keeps rolling?
What, I'm robust? Is that what you mean?
No, the wonderful point on...
Oh, yeah, right. Sorry.
It's about the athletes. It's not about the titles. That's just... Coaches, please, please listen to those words. No more important ones have been said to youth coaches in our system. So, yeah.
I like it. Done well. Team captains and team leaders when you pick your team, do you pick them or do you allow the team to pick them? And what are the pros and cons of both? Jenny, you got this one.
I think 9 times out of 10, I'm big on the players pick. I don't care how old they are because they're not as silly as what we think. I'm big on a voting system, 3-2-1, and it's done on their own and then it's handed to the coach. And what you'll find is normally who you think should be ends up being the captain or the co-captains or however a leadership group or whatever you want. But you also have to be careful, though, that a lot of people that may be seen as leaders may not want the title. It may actually go the other way and be, you know, harm their development and feel more pressure put on them. And so we've just got to make sure that that's not an issue either. But for me, I'm big on players pick. I think it's just more accepted that way. I think there's better buy-in that way because at the end of the day, they pick them, not the coach. And when it's picked by the coach, sometimes I think you can go, well, that's the coach's favourite and, you know, blah, 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 and you can get into a murky kind of situation. But also with the voting, for those that like to have the control as a coach, you can pretend the votes went a certain way and just end up picking who you wanted anyway, which I know happens as well, which I'm not a fan of, but that's just another segue into getting what you want. But I think you'll find that most times, often than not, the kids or the athletes, regardless of the age, will end up picking the best person, in my opinion, for the job.
Yeah, and it's difficult because obviously the younger they are, the more it turns into a bit of a popularity contest with who's my mate, that sort
of
stuff.
I guess the thing is, what age, when do you need a captain? Like,
true.
Under 12s, to me, I'm like, I don't think that's necessary. Under 14s, probably even not. I think once you get to 16s, maybe. I don't know. I just thought of it then. Like, when do you need them? When is it important? Yep.
Coops?
Yeah, I agree. I think that the important part there to you is that nomination aspect of it, is that who wants the responsibility and you know, who's ready to take it on and continue to be the best player that they can be. And I agree. I think players need to do it. That's how you create your buy-in. And then something I've been talking about recently with some coaches, and again, in my own experience, and I think I stole this a little bit off Corey Close, but how much are we doing to develop leaders? So if the players pick someone that maybe you didn't want to be a leader, or you can see might struggle with it, or even is a good leader but just needs more help, how are we supporting them? What sort of mechanisms and strategies are we providing to help create the best leader we can for the team and for the coaching staff and so on? So I think there's some more room for all of us as coaches to keep exploring.
Yep. Rob, story time on this one, which is very rare in itself. I certainly know that there was one of my under 16 teams, we did ask the athletes, this is one of our state teams, like, who wants to be captain? Number of hands went up, and it sort of said, well, who doesn't want to be captain? And probably the most immature kid in that group put his paw up and said, I don't want to be captain. And it's like, well, this is kind of counterintuitive, because by actually saying that, I now feel like you might actually show some leadership possibilities here where you've done the right thing. But I know I've certainly stacked the deck. in a couple of teams where it's a little bit cliquish, and I don't necessarily trust that they're potentially going to identify a leader so much they're going to identify their mate. So we would always tell them, a little bit to what you were alluding to before, Jenny, you guys vote, but the coaches vote. And what we don't tell you is you get to vote 3-2-1 and the coaches get to vote 20. So whichever direction that goes in, we'll end up with our captain. So I know for sure on one of my state teams, and I anticipate none of them are listening to this, there was one kid that ended up captain that was not necessarily voted for as captain by the playing group. It certainly came from the coaching staff. And in that situation, we just made the kid that everyone voted for vice-captain, and no one really knew any different in that situation. But it is, it's, I mean, when do you need them? We only needed it for 16 nationals. We didn't really need it for any other way. Like, you can really tell who the players are that are leaders anyway. So it's not a vital part of it, I don't think, especially for VJBL coaches, but it is something you need to be a little bit mindful of potentially sort of moving forwards. Our next question, we are punching through these. Foul trouble. Coops, do you have rules on keeping players out of foul trouble? Are you, if you get your third foul in the first half, you sit regardless? Are you, you know, we'll manage it? What are you doing in that space?
Depends. Of course. Depends. Depends on the athlete. If I don't trust the athlete to be able to play with fouls, and they've proven to us in the past that, you know, they have those techniques around, you know, chest blows, walling up, you know, things that we've discussed, usually two in the first quarter and we'll yank them. We had a player this year who struggled with that and ended up on the bench more often than not. But I've definitely trusted players to play with fouls in the past, and they've proven that they can do that. So, yeah, it's really up to them.
Yep. What about you, Jenny? Because you do obviously want to be careful that you don't foul the player out unintentionally by sitting them. And you know, how many times have we seen a player have two fouls in the first half? We sit them and they finish the game with two fouls.
Yeah, exactly. And then they, you know, fizz out of the game, and because they've just sat there for so long. I'm with Coops. There's context. It depends on the time of the game, the score of the game, the person you're dealing with. I think it also comes down to the referees in terms of, are they just, with no disrespect to them, are they just out for this person tonight? And no matter what they do, are they just going to call a foul? But I think it's also a great opportunity to allow players to grow through these moments of adversity and learn how to play through not fouling, and challenging them and knowing that it could go belly up and it could cost you a game at some point. But if they're on their, you know, fourth foul and it's in the third quarter or wherever in the fourth and you need them to stay on, can they play through? Can they come up to and meet you at that point and do that? And I think sometimes we get so scared of not doing that that we never teach them how to do it. So, you know, I would encourage coaches to sometimes just gamble a little bit to allow kids or players, whoever you have, to potentially learn that skill. And it is a skill. Another thing you have to learn or read is how heated is the person that's getting these fouls. So if they're getting pretty shirty every time something's not going their way and they're just going to keep fouling, well, then you need to drag them as well, because that's not going to help the situation. So I'm pretty along the lines with Coops on this one. Context is everything.
Yeah, and tactically we can help as coaches too. Like, we can hide them on maybe a better matchup for them. We can stop pressing up the floor where they're going to be in a position to put their hands in, or we can switch them off the dominant post that they keep fouling in there as well. We can find ways to hide them, I feel like, as well, which, you know, you don't, hide's probably a bad word for junior development, so to speak, but there are ways that we can absolutely manage that as well, I think is a better way of putting it. Keys to giving feedback. What is the best way? What is the difficult way? Do you believe in the feedback sandwich, which is like that positive, constructive, positive? Where are you at, Jenny? What do you do in this space?
Feedback, I think, comes in many forms, and we live in a generation now that everyone wants feedback. And they want it now, and they sometimes, the feedback that they hear isn't what they want. So are they actually getting any better is the question, because they've been told to ask for feedback because that's what you do, you know. But I think we need to realise that there's feedback in the immediate, in the acute, which happens on court, in training. It may not be directed at the players, but it should be absorbed by everyone. That is feedback. That is a learning opportunity. And a lot of athletes think, well, I don't get feedback. It's like, hang on, do I not speak in the training session every single day? Just because I'm not directing it at you doesn't mean it doesn't apply to you. That one really frustrates me, because then that tells me that they're not actually paying attention at all, unless it's actually directed at them. Secondly, I think it's really important, obviously, you give feedback in games if you've got assistant coaches. I think that is really important, coming in off the court, getting feedback, knowing when to give it. Sometimes players might be heated and they might need a moment. Just let them breathe, come down at a certain time. Always come down to their level. I know that sounds like quite the nanny show. When you're dealing with the child, you come down to their level. But I think that's really important from a power point of power play. Like, you don't want to stand over the top of someone and give them feedback, especially if they're heated or uncomfortable or anxious. Come down to their level, meet them in the eyes and give them the feedback. And then I'm also about the written feedback as well, because then it can't be changed. It's there, and it can't be interpreted any other way. So whether it's based on the rubrics you use, whether it's based on a system of goal setting that you use, that's another way that you can give feedback to players. Because remember, feedback can be given one way, interpreted another, and then told to another person, like Chinese whispers, and you've missed half the conversation. And I'm sure that happens with a lot of kids in the pathway. Well, you know, the coach didn't tell me this, so that's all the parent heard, which is actually not the case at all. Whereas if it's written, well, here you go. We've got it all for you. So, yeah, I'm big on feedback in terms of what you said in positive, you know, the positive, negative, positive. I'm going to say it depends. I know, I'm sorry. If it's a kid that you're not with very often, then I think that's needed. But if you know the person well enough or the player well enough, sometimes I think direct feedback is the best, and honest feedback. If you play around with people you know, you're sarcastic in your feedback, then that's when I think it's fraught with danger. If you're just direct and honest, it might hurt to start with, but I think you got more chance of it, and it's done in the right tone, of course, then I think you've got better chances of it being absorbed rather than the opposite.
Yep. What about you, Coops?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, there's just some great points there. I wholeheartedly agree with. The only other one for me is, again, I come back to self-awareness, and trying to find some ways of growing that attribute within people. And so I'll do that annoying psych thing of, you know, hey, Coops, what do you think I need to work on? Well, what do you think you need to work on? Which obviously can be frustrating at times, but, you know, I want to know from them, you know, how are they seeing the game? You know, how are they seeing their own development? What are strengths and weaknesses that they've identified, that we can explore in a feedback conversation that could then, you know, shape, you know, some written feedback. Of course, if there's some things I think I need to add, I'll add them. But I think that can be a really good, a really good way to go about it as well.
So on that, Coop, we'll piggyback. How do you go about asking for feedback as a player and as a coach in that space? Is it as simple as I'll walk up to the coach straight after this game and say, coach, I need feedback on how I went?
No, it should never be a knee-jerk reaction. You know, whether you're a coach and you missed out on a state team, or you're an athlete that's had a bad game, you need to take time in reflection. You need to again, just take that moment in self-awareness and write some things down. Okay, maybe, you know, why do I think that I didn't get it? Or why do I think, you know, I didn't play that well? Or you know, there's some things that I have done well that I can bring up with the coach or whoever it may be. And I think once you've done that, it's going to help have a more honest and fluid conversation rather than just going back, again, heated, knee-jerk, a little bit like what Jenny was talking about. And, you know, maybe you've already have a preconceived idea of what the feedback's going to be, and, you know, then it's falling on deaf ears. So I think that's the best way to start is take that moment in reflection, write some things down, and go in with an open mind, politely, respectfully, to have a discussion on how to get better.
Yep, like it. Jenny, what would you do in that space?
in a developmental pathway point of view for a younger athlete, normally they're coming to you because it's normally going to be about court time, or they feel like they've been misused, mismanaged, whatever. It's not going to be, and I would prefer it, and I would encourage it to any coaches and especially parents that are listening, that it's not the parents asking for the feedback, that you've got to instill in your child the confidence and the courage to go up and have those conversations. Now, you may need to sit down with your kid and work out what you're going to say, and that's an even better point, because it shouldn't be, why didn't you play me? Because that's a victim mentality. It's like, coach, I really want to get better because I want to contribute more to the team and by that, hopefully play more. Can you please tell me what I can do in order to achieve that? And I think that comes with an ownership rather than a victim mentality. So I think you've just got to be careful with the feedback, that you're asking the question the right way. Now, sometimes that's a hard pill to swallow, because you probably think you haven't done anything wrong as a player, and it's all on the coach. But I think it's better received that way when you go to a coach and take, be seen to take a responsibility perhaps. And I think you'll get a lot better reaction from the coach with that, rather than, well, why didn't you play me? Yep. That doesn't serve any purpose at all. So I think, yeah, for me it's big. Parents shouldn't be asking for the feedback. It should be coming from the players. I don't care what age you are. Like, you should feel comfortable enough to have that conversation if you need to. And I'm big on the emotion one as well. Neil played for the Melbourne Tigers under Lindsay Gaze, and he always remembers Lindsay never, ever spoke to the team after a game, ever. He never spoke on emotion. He never made decisions on emotion. He always slept on them. So I think it's really important that it should never be after a game that you go up and want to get feedback, unless it's in a tournament situation where you need that immediate feedback. If it's just one game a week, I think just let it ride out a little bit, and just make sure that self-reflection that Coops talks about all the time, that you're ticking the boxes that are needed in order to get the trust from the coach and be able to play.
Excellent. I like it. Last question. I'll go to Jenny first on this one, because Coops, you may need a little bit of time to compose some thoughts on this one. If you could change anything in junior basketball, what would it be?
If I could change anything in junior basketball, what would it be? You know what, that we don't play all year round. Oh, people are going to hate me for that one. I just think, especially up to a certain age, I don't think basketball all year round is beneficial for anyone. I think we're losing, and I'm putting my sports science hat on here, I think we're losing the ability to kids to be multifaceted, multidimensional. You know, we have chronic injuries, chronic issues coming up because people, it's not so much the load of what they do. It's that they're doing the same thing repetitively over and over and over again all year round. And that's why those injuries and especially the long-term bone injuries and stress fractures that you see coming up in kids is because they play all year round. Kids grow. They need time to rest and recuperate. They also need to explore how to play other sports. Now, playing another sport doesn't mean you go and play that sport and that's where you go, and you may, but it also could enhance your ability to be a great basketball player. And for me personally, I saw that. I played netball as a kid. I learned the best footwork and the ability to pass the ball and move in small confined spaces. It was perfect for me to then shift into basketball and then be able to play that game. So for me, junior basketball, it would be that we don't play all year round. Sorry.
It's a really valid one. I know in New Zealand, they've gone down the balance is better pathway with a number of the sports signing on to say, well, we're not going to overload our kids. We're going to all work together and make sure that there's a little bit of balance involved. And like Belgium are really big on the multi-move programs with their youth athletes. And that's not sports specific, up to a certain age where they literally just learn fundamental movement skills, which is a really big part of it. So being able to develop a whole person rather than a specific athlete for a specific sport, I think is a really valid point. I think it's a really good one. Coops, off the long run, what do you got?
Yeah, look, it's the same. It's the same. We playing all year round.
No, I know you can't say that. Come on. There must have been a million things going through your head about junior basketball than just piggybacking onto that. Come on. You can't finish on that.
Well, one of the most important things is our athletes just don't have time to get better. And I know, again, that's kind of falls in the same line, but, you know, we've got athletes coming through, you know, our Friday night system and after however long, you know, 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s, they still can't shoot. And, you know, they don't have time. They don't have time because we want them going to school and we want them playing different sports. We want them doing different things. They need time to go away and invest. And if you're talking about like an American or European system, the fact they have an off season, they can go away, they can get in the gym, they can put weight on, they can increase their speed in their first step, they can make an adjustment to their shot technique. We don't have that. Our kids really, really struggle to be able to just go away and invest in themselves. And until they do that or have the ability to do that, we're just not going to produce as many athletes as we could. So I think that's one. If I can be a little bit more controversial, I think our more elite athletes need...
That's not like you, Coos. You're never controversial.
Our elite athletes need one voice. Our elite athletes need time in one program. You know, especially the VMPP, I think they should be playing big V basketball as a team, you know, with the HPCs coaching them. So they get what we were talking about earlier. They get an understanding of terminology. They get time together. It's one voice. It's a clear message. It's time spent in one environment just to really grow and enhance in something that's really dedicated to them, not a school thing that runs for 8 weeks, not a club that's worried about grading, not an individual skill development coach that's worried about money. You know, if we can bring our better kids into one environment that's dedicated purely to them, we're just giving those kids the best chance to succeed. And that's our job. That's what we're in this for, is for the kids. So we need to be doing that.
Yeah, really interesting. A lot of other countries and sports have actually invested in that. I know Belgium soccer is one, Icelandic soccer is another one. Like, their ability to produce athletes despite the population size at a high end is really impressive. And a lot of that is they go and pick the green bananas that we were talking about, which is a fantastic Chris Vanderhagen term, which, you know, shrine to Chris somewhere in this house somewhere without question. But that it is, it's one of those things where they go and pick the long-term athletes, they put them in a team and they play younger than what they're actually in their age group of. So they'd be, say, under 15 kids playing against under 13 level kids because their skill set and their maturity potentially matches the under 13 level, but their long-term ability, they're a little bit unco still. They haven't quite got the motor skills yet. So they play against probably a more relative age group for where they're actually at. So it's the ability to take them out, and then they can still go and play for their clubs and all that sort of stuff. It's not a massive time in position, but just different ways of doing things, I think, is always really interesting to explore as well. It's just because we've always done it this way doesn't mean we have to keep doing it this way. And I'm sure, probably to hit on both of your points, there's a very real chance after these lockdowns end, nobody's ever going to want to break from sport again. That they will happily play 365 days of the year, which brings with it its own problems without question. But there's a very real chance that we can definitely look at the calendar. I know the VJBL did put out an alternative calendar this year, I think it was off the top of my head, with some alternative dates and ways to structure the season as well. So certainly something to look at, I think, for the future as well.
We need the clubs in that, Rob. Like, that we won't get change without investment from the clubs in looking at the way that we do things and wanting to make change and wanting to be more invested in helping their athletes succeed in the sport that we all love. So hope to see more clubs get together and look at innovative ways that are happening both at home and away, and start making their voices heard and see if we can't shake things up and be a better state and therefore a better country for it.
Like it. Guys, thank you very much. Appreciate you jumping in. That does...
Ash, like, wind it up, buddy.
We are done for this podcast. The robust Jenny Screen, the Dick Dastardly Nathan Cooper Brown, appreciate your time on this earthquake laden Wednesday morning.
I know, an earthquake. Crazy.
Yeah, as if we're not dealing with enough. It's quite impressive.
We're falling apart, Victoria. We're falling apart. But we will rebuild.
Betty's Burgers will come back bigger and stronger and with a large fries. Just make sure you upgrade next time you go there. They could probably use the additional help putting their second story back on. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, coaches, for jumping into the podcast. We will hopefully catch you guys again next week. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we will see you all then. Look, tune in and join the tribe on iTunes and Spotify.